a perfect introduction because we've talked about several things that have led that other. Oh yes, we'll talk about finance. There's no financial relationships to disclose, so let me continue. So a lot of what's talked about youth voice through digital storytelling, working with communities to find research, to create research that makes sense for them and that helps them do services. In Northwest Alaska, and actually I see a colleague of mine from up there, we've been doing that sort of work in Northwest Alaska for, boy, since 95. And so we have lots of different stories to tell about this. But today what I'd like to do is tell about a project that we did, which is very small, and really it's just focused on data collection as health promotion, and the focus being intergenerational dialogue. So bringing adults and elders together with youth to learn from each other. And that's actually what we've heard in the last three speakers. So this is just a little microcosm of some of the ways in which that can be done. So I'll begin. Oh, and I should also give a background. I started off as a clinical social worker in Northwest Alaska. It was my first real job, and I actually became an adult in Kotzebue. So it's like my growing up experience. And I haven't really left, and it's been a while. All right. So what I'd like to do is outline some ideas about community-based participatory research, and I think we've heard some really great examples of that, but I just want to identify what we're trying to achieve by doing community-based participatory research versus collaborative research versus other approaches. And then I want to describe to you one method in a really small pilot study that we did that we're calling Intergenerational Dialogue, Exchange, and Action. And that was done in collaboration with Akaluk Trust and Manilik Association, which are two tribal entities in Northwest Alaska. And so I want to talk about how that approach was created in process. So we tried some stuff, and it seemed to work, and I'll tell you why we think it worked and what we think it worked to achieve. So to begin with, I'll give you a small summary of where we are. So that little tiny area map is Alaska, and that green area is Northwest Alaska, the area that we're working in. Manilik Association works with all those red dots, all those villages. The villages range from populations of 90. Kobuk has 90 residents. Kotzebue has about 3,000. Point Hope has about 1,500. So there's no roads connecting any of these villages. The other thing that's unique about Alaska Native villages is there was never a reservation system, but through the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, I don't even know where to begin with that, but in the 70s, it's very complicated, but tribal groups were not put on a specific land base separated from where they grew up, but settlements. So these were migratory groups, Inupiaq or migratory people, and these villages are where the schools and the missions were located. And if you think about the history of colonization in Northwest Alaska, it's a fairly recent phenomenon. So in the last 100 years is when mission schools were created, right around the turn of last century. And there were huge epidemics, DIOS, in the early 1900s and then in the 1930s, where some villages lost up to 80% of the residents. 80% of the residents died. And those were young people and those were old people. And if you think about the importance of elders' wisdom, that is a huge trauma. Even people who are alive today, the elders that are alive today, were sent away to boarding schools, many times in the lower 48. And I have stories from older people who, you know, were taken away from their families, no choices about that, taken away from their families, taught not to speak their language, taught not to do traditional activities, and still now don't have some traditional wisdom that they wished they had growing up. So those traumas are really recent, and they're lived. They're lived today. And the parents of today's young people, that generation, were raised by people who were hurt because they were doing cultural activities, that were not allowed to speak their indigenous language. So if you think about that and you think about intergenerational trauma and we talk about health disparities, I think we need to look at some of these ways in which colonization is made manifest in these experiences of different generations. So these are some of our villages. Kotzebue is the largest village in the region, and that is up to the left. We have inland villages and coastal villages, but all the villages in this region are Inupiaq culturally. Okay, so I gave you a little bit of history on the difference in elders' experiences and the difference in today's parents, aunts and uncles' experiences. So the youth have a different experience. They were born and raised in the communities in which they now live. They speak English as their primary secondary language. They speak a different sort of English than standard English. And many times, the elders speak primarily Inupiaq. So if you think about that, and we have the, you know, we have a saying, you know, oh, they're speaking different languages. Well, literally, they are. So elders and young people have different primary languages that they're speaking. So if you think about the importance of social roles and you think about the importance of teaching younger people what it means to be an adult woman or what it means to be an adult man, who gives that guidance and how do they do it? So many times it's done through language, so we teach. Many times it's done through demonstration and traditional learning patterns, storytelling and demonstration is key. Now, if you think about how this shakes out for young people today who begin school years just at the peak harvest season, okay? So parents, grandparents are going out on the land to get food for the year, and young people have to be back in school. So even that kind of traditional heritage, that kind of traditional learning currently today is taking place. So colonization is not something that happened back then when the epidemics happened, when elders were being punished for speaking their language. It's happening today even when we think about how we do schooling for our kids. We do not make it easy for them to get the cultural knowledge that's important for them to learn how to be contributing members of their family, contributing members of their communities. And so what becomes really important then is to how can we bridge the gap so that elders can have access to teaching young people about what it means to be a responsible adult in this community. How can we give adults avenues to teach young people what it means to live in both worlds, or all three worlds, or all 20 million worlds that they're navigating every day? It's not just two worlds, because there's no discrete distinction, right? It's fluid. And these worlds move together, and kids have to learn how to navigate them on a minute-by-minute level. So, do I give eye contact here because I'm in a Western world where that means that I'm showing respect, or am I in an Inupiaq situation where doing that can be not the right thing to do to an elder? Looking down, listening, paying attention in other ways would show respect better. So learning how to navigate those worlds, knowing when to be different kinds of people in different kinds of situations becomes incredibly important for youth. And it's not something that you can learn through curriculum in school or through Inupiaq days in that hour that the school district gives. And I think that tribal communities in the region that I work with are beginning to look at the broader picture. So yes, we do have Inupiaq classes, but how can we change it so that we have an Inupiaq school year? How can we push sovereignty to that level? Because kids are dying. Literally, kids are dying. And if you think about the average young man in many Native groups and in Alaska Native men in general, they're dying at 53 years old. That's way more than the 2 years that I heard from another tribal group difference. Hugely different. So it's important. It's important that this learning continues, and we tried to figure out ways to bring research to bear and to make those opportunities more available for people. So that's the story that I'm going to tell. So when people think about young people, and I've just sort of laid out some of the issues that are in play, Young people are the hope for the future. They're important on so many levels. And they're important culturally. They're important demographically. And when young men, are at the greatest risk for dying early. And when they're dying, they're losing a big hole. They're leaving a big hole in all sorts of things. And local people are feeling like somehow they're failing their kids. Somehow they've let go of their kids. And this has repercussions that are intergenerational. So how do you begin to solve that? This is an important thing that people are doing currently, trying to fix it. But it's a big problem. And I started talking to you a little bit about how we could think about school classes, or we can think about the whole school year. And we've really begun to move towards thinking about the whole school year. We've begun to think about how to take back some things. Suicide, substance abuse, a lot of the things that we've heard about can be seen as a consequence of these larger social forces. So trying to build some of those back, pushing for sovereignty, and Chandler and Lalonde in British Columbia have done some work about empowerment, community empowerment as suicide prevention. Voice, youth voice as suicide prevention. So when people feel like they can have a say in their future, and when they know how to get that done, they do better. When they have a purpose, and when they have people to lead them into a new way to be, they do much better. So how do you get some of this stuff back? CBPR is a way forward, not the only one. We've heard about some amazing other ways forward at this conference. So some of the ways in which I think CBPR, community-based participatory research, is a really useful tool is it responds to community issues, community priorities. It allows researchers to help local people distill understandings that are meaningful to them. It builds local capacity for research, but much more beyond. And it builds credibility. I mean, I think that's where I come in. That's where research is helpful. It builds credibility. It can create opportunities for knowledge sharing and for moving forward together. And I think we've seen some great examples of that. So intergenerational dialogue, exchange, and action was one way that we did it. And what we did was we went into the communities and we said, okay, we want to learn with youth. So tell us who are some at-risk youth, some kids who have had troubles that we can work with that you think would be interested in working with us on a research project that's really trying to look at youth roles, looking at health promotion, looking at resilience. How are people getting through things? And so they picked kids who had had a suicide attempt in the last 6 months. They picked kids who had been in jail in the last 6 months. They picked kids who are generally speaking, when we think about, not easy kids to reach. And these kids stepped up and stayed involved. So we've given the opportunity to think about their lives, to talk to each other, to get support, and to build bridges with people that they respected in their community. They stepped up and stayed with it. So we asked them what they wanted to learn about. And in research jargon, resilience is what we ended up studying. And really, they wanted to know what people that they respected went through when they were growing up and how they got through it. How did they get through it? That's resilience. And so they identified older people that they wanted to learn from, and we brought them together. So instead of doing interviews with me, the researcher, and the adult or the elder as the interviewee, we did the interviews with a whole audience of youth. And we created the questions that we were going to ask together. And it's not super appropriate for the kids to be asking those questions to adults and elders, but it's fine for me to. And it's fine for my colleague who is from the community to do so, who is an adult. So we asked elders and adults that the kids nominated about their lives, what they went through, how they got through them, what was important for them, what is important about being a man today, what is important about being a woman today, How do they navigate those many worlds in which they have to? What do they think of as success? Are there many different pathways to it? Yes. And the kids were amazingly attentive. And the participants were amazingly generous with their stories. And none of them took our participant's stipend as a thank you. Not one. So that also tells me that for the adults and the elders, it was a power, it was a good experience for them. It wasn't just about data collection. In fact, that was like the least of it. It was really about having a venue to talk to kids about what they thought was important for kids to know. And the kids got to help direct that and really bring it into what they were dealing with by asking questions that were relevant for their lives and for their futures. So after doing that, we had the kids produce digital stories from what they learned. And it was fascinating because we interviewed the kids before and we interviewed the kids after. And the narratives that they picked up from the adults, you could see verbatim some of the ways in which they were describing what it meant to be Inupiaq, what it meant to be successful, how you can sort of be strong and get through things. They had a whole cultural narrative that built on cultural identity. They definitely added to it. That pushed them to think about their lives differently. And every single one of those digital stories was about what I'm going to do with my life now. What it means to be successful for me now. What it means to be part of this strong group. These strong people. And then we did a community sharing where we invited those elders and the adults who did the interviews back and family members that the kids wanted to have. And we all shared in a community screening of the kids' stories. And it generated new conversations. And all of these pieces, all of these different elements are data that we can use to think about what is cultural resilience? What kinds of messages might be really important for kids to know? How are people navigating the many different worlds they need to? So it was useful on many different fronts. And I think in doing so, it was it sort of epitomized CBPR and what we hope to achieve in doing that. And that's the end. Thank you very much. I want to do a big shout out for Erica Nelson and George Provost and Sakura Martha Whiting, Nancy Rich, Stacey Harris, who was the research assistant on this, all the Youth Digital Storytellers, and the National Science Foundation.
Thank you.